Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. And they have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We are so glad that you are here. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State. My AccuWindow forecast says it's warmed up quite a bit. Actually, got the two-wheeler out this week and did a little bit of riding. We are going to leave the phone lines open all night tonight. We'll give those numbers out right after the news here. The solar wind is a strong 641 kilometers per second, and the sun is completely blank today. There are high looping prominences and very little proton activity right now. We are waiting for sunspots that are more in line with solar cycle 24, which began a few months ago. This one is expected to be very active and may cause havoc with electronics like satellites and computers. More than 8,000 NASA contractor jobs in the nation's manned space program could be eliminated after the space shuttle program is shut down in 2010, the agency said Tuesday. Florida Governor Charlie Crist said the state was committed to trying to blunt the impact of the job losses with an aggressive effort to lure new contractors to the area that would work with future NASA flights, as well as private launches. In all, he said, the state was trying to attract more than 50 space-related firms to the state. Now, I've seen this before when they have shut down Air Force bases. The local economy panics, but in a few years, literally just a very few years, they see that the private sector is much more efficient and much more profitable than the government was at running the agency. So perhaps NASA will experience unprecedented growth with this move. Messenger's new picture of Mozart shows something Mariner 10 missed. Strange dark markings on the crater floor of the moon and dark rays shooting across the crater's upthrust rims. What is this material? No one knows, but it is probably kin to the mysterious dark halos found around other craters in nearby Caloris Basin. Spectral data gathered by Messenger and being analyzed now by mission scientists may yet reveal Mozart's composition. Last week, we had a great guest on. You need to go back and listen to that if you missed it. The book was awesome. The films were good. We had Ken Klein on. He was talking about the mystery of the pyramids, who built them and why, and are the builders going to return? This week, we have the author of God at the Speed of Light. He is a medical consultant who has explored into the spectrum containing spirituality and science to explain that area just beyond our imagination. According to his research in this amazing book, ranging from near-death experiences to quantum physics, your understanding of the creation of the universe and all life in it is about to expand. Please welcome with me Dr. T. Lee Bauman. How are you, Lee?
I'm very well, Brooks. Thank you so much for having me. And I was going to say just call me Lee, but you already got that memo.
Oh, that's good. That's good. I am also wearing my favorite red T-shirt. I got that memo, too, so hopefully we're wearing the same.
Excellent.
Excellent book. I am going to leave the phone lines open all night. Last week, we had a technical difficulty. As you know, this is the program where we switch from Channel 1 to Channel 2 with BBS Radio Network. And we love our listeners from all over the world, but the phone lines were routed for an overseas guest, and they did not get switched back. So we apologize if you are not able to call in. Our numbers, toll-free in the United States, are 888-228-4494. Anywhere toll-free in Canada, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154 or 776-5185. And for those of you that are using Skype, you can reach us simply at BBS Radio. If you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. We also want to welcome our listeners with the Steeleye Media Network tonight as well. Now, Lee, you start the book with near-death experiences, and I imagine that you see more of these in the hospital than the average observer. And you recount many that come from other authors.
The vast majority have come from other authors. I was trained in internal medicine and geriatrics, so I did certainly have my own share of people who I resuscitated. And my wife is an emergency room physician, so she certainly saw an equal number, probably more. So we always had interesting stories that we could relate to one another about near death and how people reacted and responded to being hopefully, successfully resuscitated. So we've been very blessed in our careers and being able to do what we are doing now.
Well, one of the things you make note of is the fact that most NDEers talk about a light in their experience, of course.
Yes.
Maybe you can tie that together for us.
Oh, I'd be happy to. As probably most of your listeners are aware, one of the key elements to the near-death experience is the being of light. For people who are Christian, they tend to identify the light with Christ. Those who are not Christian tend to identify the light with God. And even to agnostics and atheists, they just tend to identify the light as being that of a guiding spirit. but everyone who sees the light tends to identify it with some type of higher being or spirit, someone who leads them and tends to answer just about every question that they have in their minds at the time through some type of telepathic medium is how most NDEers express, you know, their what they've been through. Now, in the mid-1970s, I was just beginning my medical career, and so I was being introduced to a lot of these, people who we had successfully resuscitated. And I, for obvious reasons, became interested in Raymond Moody's book that came out in 1975, Life After Life. This was really the first book that defined and explained what the near-death experience was. Many people had had the experience up to this time, but they had found that whenever they attempted to discuss it with relatives or good friends, they typically were not believed, and they abandoned their attempts to try to explain what had happened to them. So Raymond Moody was really the key researcher who brought the near-death experience into an acceptable realm where people felt free to discuss it, and it's pretty widely accepted now as being, you know, a real medical element. So from that standpoint, people now are not as reticent to, you know, discuss their near-death experiences. At about the same time in the mid-1970s, there were a lot of books hitting the lay press dealing with Albert Einstein and his special theory of relativity. For inexplicable reasons, I found the fact that in his theory that if you could travel at light speed, that time stopped. For some reason, there was just something very mystical and almost supernatural about this. At the time, I really did not believe in God. I had been raised as a Christian, but several things had happened not only in my adolescence, but as I went through my biology undergraduate at Vanderbilt, and then as I entered medical school, the medical or the scientific method is pounded into your brain that really, if you can't prove something, then you have to question its true existence. And I, even to this day, am a firm believer in the scientific method. I could never accept the premise of God based upon faith alone. So I had given up any spirituality, you know, many years before. So in the mid-1970s, I was pretty much an agnostic and atheist. Through the near-death experience by Raymond Moody, where the element or the being of light was probably the key element to that phenomenon, and then through quantum physics, where light, physical light, is really the cornerstone to quantum mechanics or quantum physics. At some point, I tied the two together, and through the world's religious sacred texts, I suddenly realized that in every religious text across the planet, how was God described? The answer to that question is God is almost universally described in terms of light. So I think that was my eureka moment, that between the near-death experience where God was often identified with the light, the fact that there were so many supernatural elements to quantum physics in descriptions of physical light, and then the last one being the fact that God is described in almost every religious text throughout the world in terms of light, I suddenly became aware I no longer believed that these comparisons of God to light were just metaphorical, which is what we've always been taught. I now truly believe that they are literal comparisons. So that, in a nutshell, is pretty much how my transformation from an agnostic to a believer now has come about, and it's all been through science.
Oh, that's great. Well, when someone talks about the nature of light as waves or particles,
yes.
Most people try to describe Young's double slit experiment. Now, he was a physician who became intensely interested in the human eye and in light. His experiment, however, has birthed a dozen different really landmark proofs. Can you walk us through a few of these?
Well, I found, and I detail the double slit experiment in God at the Speed of Light. Honestly, when I give my talks now throughout the world on my writings, I find it's very difficult to try to explain the double slit without pictures and diagrams. What I found is probably a better replacement to the traditional double slit is the quantum eraser experiment. And again, even to avoid the complexities of even that much simpler experiment, I can try to simplify it in a verbal attempt at any rate. The experiment basically has a single photon or a single wave of light which enters the experimental setup. And it passes through a crystal, and it is actually broken into two smaller photons. And these smaller photons basically then go through the setup, and then they arrive at the end of the setup. So just to simplify, we basically have the beginning of the experiment, the middle of the experiment, and the end of the experiment. What the researchers found was they could actually make changes at the very end of the experiment, and what they observed was that light altered its behavior in the middle of the experiment. Now, for traditional believers and people who have been brought up and educated through classic Newtonian physics, this is impossible. You know, what was observed during the quantum eraser and actually the double slit as well just are phenomenon which are impossible, and even Richard Feynman made a quote very similar to that, that, you know, what was being observed is just something which is impossible with the double slit experiment. But what the researchers failed to take into account, and I believe fully explains everything that happens in both the double slit and the quantum eraser, is that we were observing for the first time that time does not exist for the photon. And in fact, just as Albert Einstein had proven, time stops. And so what we as humans observed to be an impossibility, that is, by making changes at the end of the experiment, caused light to alter its behavior in the middle of the experiment, which just doesn't make any sense at all, what we were actually and are actually witnessing in that experiment is that the light travels to the end of the experiment. For inexplicable reasons, identifies those changes. Because time does not exist, it travels basically back in time to the middle of the experiment, alters its behavior, and what we see is an alteration in its pathways and trajectories, which we now measure again at the end of the experiment. So I hope I've explained that in fairly lay terms, that what we are witnessing is that time stops, and it's just incredible.
Right. The main thing to remember about the experiment, and if you... Most of our listeners will never get a chance to perform the experiment, although it's pretty elementary as far as the mechanical setup of it. But when waves interact with one another, there's interference, which creates this light and dark areas on the screen. But when light behaves as a particle, it leaves only a single light mark on the screen as a probability.
Exactly.
But what can cause a photon to act like a particle? What? How does it change? How does it go from being a wave to collapsing into a particle?
Well, exactly, and I know, Brooks, that you already have the answer to that, but the answer, at least how I see it, is explained through something known as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Copenhagen interpretation basically states is that everything, and we're talking electrons, photons, and actually even matter itself, exists as waves up until the time it is observed. And at the time that either a measuring device measures something, or at the time that a human being observes an event, all those waves, whether it be an electron wave or a light wave or even a proton wave, suddenly then collapses into particulate or particle form. And it's known in the physics world as the collapse of the wave function. So really, the Copenhagen interpretation, I feel, has a full explanation for the old wave-particle duality that physicists have always struggled with over the last millennia. And so that is, at least in simple terms, how I explain the discrepancy between waves at one time and particles at the other. And it's all...
Well, I totally agree with that. I think that what we are faced with here are some amazing, not only philosophical, but fundamentally scientific viewpoints that we're going to take into consideration over our 3 hours, because they have profound meaning, not only for, you know, the state of the universe, but also to our place in the universe and our involvement
Yes.
in the universe. So we're going to cover that in depth over the 3 hours, because this is
very good,
most interesting. But let's lay a little bit more foundation work this hour, and then our listeners, because most of our listeners do not listen live; they're doing other things on Sunday evening.
Yes.
But we have a rather unique and eclectic global audience of several million people, and they go to work on Monday morning, pull this up on their computer and listen, and they're sitting there with a PC and a credit card in their hand, so that's very interesting.
Technology is wonderful.
Yeah. Let's tell our guests how they can get a hold of your book besides the bookstores.
Well, you're very kind. Actually, any internet bookseller, whether it be Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Amazon, they all have them, and they have all four of my books. So I would recommend that they choose the one that they are most familiar with or already has their credit card on account and use them.
Well, I'm going to add the other three to my collection. Let's get back to laying some foundation. How about...
Yes.
Observing the proton after the pattern is on the screen, this quantum eraser, you're saying that you're observing the particle after, at least from our viewpoint, after it has already gone through a portion of the detection where it has already displayed itself as a wave. And so now you're going to detect it as a particle, and it's going to go back in time and change itself to a particle going through the screen. So it shows up not as waves, but it shows up as particles, even though you didn't observe it as a particle until after it hit the screen.
Well, actually, that comparison relates more with the double slit experiment. And I think the way you explained it is excellent, and I would have nothing to add to that. With the quantum eraser experiment, it's more a description of which pathways the photons, and it's probably easier for the listener to visualize a particle photon as opposed to a wave. The pathways actually change in, at least in the quantum eraser experiment I'm thinking of, And unfortunately, just to add to the confusion, not only are there different double slit type of experiments, there are different type of quantum eraser experiments, and there's even one that does use a double slit and observes interference. So all of this can be quite confusing. The quantum eraser experiment that I describe in God at the Speed of Light and my third book, The Akashic Light, basically, if you could just visualize the photons which have split in two as particles, it's probably easier for your listeners. And what the experimenters have done has been that they've placed polarized pieces of glass at the very end of the experiment, right in front of photon detectors. And but at the previous modification of the experiment, it was already known that the photons, one was headed to one detector and another photon was headed toward the other detector, there being only two detectors in the experiment. And at the time that they placed these polarized pieces of glass in front of both of the detectors for the final modification, now instead of both photons or each photon going to a separate detector, they now both go to a single detector. Being, at least in my mind, that the photons have now detected the polarized pieces of glass, have gone back to a time earlier in the experiment, which I would just call the middle, have altered their behavior to where they now both go to a single detector instead of each one going to a separate detector. I hope what I've just said makes some sense.
Yeah, but that's
the gist of it.
A lot clearer. But doesn't this imply a sort of awareness on the part of the photon?
Oh, I agree completely. I think, at least from our human interpretation of it, not only does time not exist, but the photons are reacting in really a conscious manner. They are altering their behavior, which is a statement which typically we use only to describe human nature and not, you know, something which we consider to be an inanimate object like light waves. I, of course, now, at this point in time, you're probably fully aware, I feel that there's more going on to light than its existence as an inanimate object. I think...
We're going to get into that in great depth, but we'll continue to lay some foundation. It's kind of like that movie Next. I think it had Nicolas Cage in it. I think he had access to like 2 minutes in the future, so he could literally do the sleight of hand and card tricks because for 2 minutes, forward or backward, and at least relative to the rest of the people around him, he could observe and make changes.
So that would explain it completely.
So light, and you write this in your book, light has an immediate knowledge of its surroundings, and it acts accordingly. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't think we have the answer to that. We know how it can do what it does because time doesn't exist. The whys...
Well, let me ask it a different way.
Yes.
What difference does it make to the light that it's being observed?
Boy, I wish I knew that answer, Brooks. I just don't think as humans we have that information.
Well, one of the things about the detector, the photon detector in the quantum erasure experiment, it doesn't detect every single photon, does it?
No, that's true.
So some of the photons don't actually get observed by the detector.
That is correct.
And yet all of the photons go back and change their behavior.
That appears to be the case, yes.
Well, that adds even more confusion to it.
This is an area where we've got Nobel Prize winners that have no explanation. I mentioned Richard Feynman making a comment that the double slit experiment is impossible, absolutely impossible to explain. And those are his words. And then we have Niels Bohr, another Nobel Prize winner, who states that those who are not shocked when they first come across quantum physics could not possibly have understood it. And I think that, you know, that says it all. Even our world's best physicists cannot explain why things are happening. We think we may have a clue as to how they are happening, but we don't have any idea why.
If I could say that concisely enough, I would replace my honk if you passed PCAM bumper sticker.
Yeah, well, what was that again?
If I could say that those who do who are not shocked by quantum physics at their first observation obviously don't understand it. If I could crunch that down to a bumper sticker, I would replace my bumper sticker that says "Honk if you passed PCAM."
I understand. Yes. In fact, I like to tell my audiences replace "shocked" with "confused," because probably most people who are not familiar with quantum mechanics.
Can you turn up your volume, Dr. Agnew? Thank you.
When they first hear about quantum physics, this is such a confusing topic. The elements are so difficult to grasp that it is very confusing. So if I can just change the term to those who are not confused the first time they hear about these concepts, you know, that probably helps a great deal.
Exactly. Is the speed of light constant?
Well, it appears to be in a vacuum. And I do emphasize in a vacuum because we do know that when it travels through water or glass, it slows down to different speeds, which is why it causes rainbows when it goes through prisms and such. But in a vacuum, which is most of what I discuss, the speed of light does appear to be constant, yes.
All right, and as we approach the speed of light, what happens to time?
What the physicists tell us, and this has been done through multiple different experiments, so I certainly accept what they say, is that as you approach the speed of light, time begins to slow. And if we could actually make the speed of light, which is really felt to be impossible, but if we could actually travel at the speed of light, time would stop. And so that then is how I have developed what I consider some of the supernatural aspects of light and why physicists describe light with the terminology they do, even using the term such as conscious.
So as time becomes zero, this means that really relative to us, light can go anywhere in the universe without expending any of our time, right?
That is such a wonderful segue, Brooks, because one of the four different elements I use to describe physical light, and again, most of these have been relatively proven time and time again, I discuss what I call the three omnis, which are omnipresence, meaning that light can literally be everywhere, omniscience, or being all-knowing, omnipotent, all-powerful, and the last term, which has been coined actually by physicists, not by Lee Bauman, but by physicists, the fourth one being consciousness. So if we go back to the first one, that of omnipresence, what I like to tell my audiences is imagine you have a light particle or a light wave starting its voyage in one corner of the universe. We as humans see that light wave traveling at a finite speed, 300,000 kilometers per second or 186,000 miles per second. And so for us, we can actually see that light wave traveling at a defined speed. But keep in mind, we as humans are trapped within the four dimensions of space and time. For light, we know that light must exist outside of those dimensions because it's been proven that time does not exist for the photon. So if you believe that, then imagine for that photon traveling perhaps all the way across to the other side of the universe. It has taken billions of years for us as humans to observe that voyage. But how long has it taken the photon whose clock has stopped? The answer, of course, is no time at all has elapsed for the photon. So there is an apparent discrepancy between us humans seeing light appear to travel at a speed because we're within the four dimensions of space and time, and the apparent contradiction that for light, no time at all transpires because it exists outside of time.
All right, I like the omnipresent part. Now, how about the omniscient part?
Well, if you can imagine, and again, if you accept the fact that time does not exist for the photon, then theoretically, if I were a photon, I could be everywhere in the universe at one time. So for the present tense, theoretically, I would know everything going on in the universe right now. Theoretically. Now,
have you had any of your NDEers come back and say, you know, wow, I know everything right at this moment?
Absolutely. It is a recurrent theme for NDEers. And that, again, fits so well, you know, within the fact that they seem to be, they've crossed that boundary, and they are now interacting with spirits of light. Everything just fits together so well. And again, if you're that photon and time has stopped, basically the past equals the present, equals the future, and so that explains why these NDEers often have all the answers to every universal question at the time that they're on the other side, but when they come back, it's gone. And it's just a marvelous comparison and an explanation.
It only hangs around for just a little bit, and they don't have enough time. Well, lifetime may not be enough time to explain everything they saw on the other side. So let's talk about the omnipotent side, the all-powerful side.
Right.
Let's talk about
the third omni, that of being light, being omnipotent. This one is perhaps a bit more controversial. It is not as solid and concrete as I would like it to be, but the physics argument comes from something known as renormalization. For people who would rather not get involved with the physics, it's probably more simple for them to understand that if you could be everywhere in the universe at one time and that you're all-knowing, you know, you're probably omnipotent as well. But if you want the physics explanation, the technique known as renormalization offers at least some credibility on the physics side. And what renormalization is that physicists back in the early 1900s when they were first trying to calculate energy levels of elementary particles, like electrons, like the most elemental element of the hydrogen atom, they kept coming up with infinities in their answers. And, of course, for mathematicians, if you end up with an infinity on one side of the equal sign, it basically destroys all of your work. So an attempt was made to find out where these infinities or these infinite values were coming from. To make a long story short, any time that you deal with electrons, whether it be an isolated electron or an electron revolving around the proton of a hydrogen atom, what chemists have long known is that electrons are intimately associated with photons. You really cannot have an electron which is not interacting with a photon, because what causes these electrons to bounce from one electron orbit to another is its interactions with photons. It turns out that through the technique of renormalization, physicists were able to get rid of these infinities by canceling the infinities out on both sides of the equations. Now, there are several physicists who have never accepted this technique. They've called it a sleight of hand, like a magician's sleight of hand. They've called it a mathematical trick. So a lot of physicists don't like the fact that a mathematical technique has been utilized to get rid of infinite values. They feel the infinite values, you know, are basically real entities which you just can't remove by a mathematical trick, and they're there, and they're there because of light. So that would come, that would be the omnipotent argument for light.
Well, yeah, and you know, there is kind of an arm wrestling match between mathematicians and physicists, and we try to master both, we really do, but it takes a lifetime in both disciplines to really master them. Even Einstein had to take a couple of years of advanced algebra to be able to express the theories that he was seeing and he was imagining. I mean, he was imaging them, but he couldn't explain them.
Exactly.
And, you know, what Lee's talking about is, you know, sometimes in mathematics, when you're putting together long statements or differentiations, you end up with exceedingly small numbers in the denominator and exceedingly large numbers in the numerator. And when the answer is worked out, you get infinity. So we come up with constants, like, you know, in the gas law, we have a constant that has in it all the units of temperature and mass and things, so that we come up with a value, a fractional value that doesn't have any units in it. And that's what we do when this is done. And when this was first done in the early 1900s, they didn't have computers. They used matrices, and one of the matrices was called the metric tensor.
Yes.
A very handy mathematical tool, but often cranked out infinities. And you can almost explain anything with this tensor, but it is known for cranking out unknowable numbers, and that's how we deal with them. We cancel them out. We just put them on both sides of the equation. So, yeah, it's maybe a little mathematical sleight of hand, but, you know, it's like subtracting 6 from both sides of the equation. You really haven't done anything to the equality, not really, but it has made, you know, unknowable numbers knowable.
Exactly, and it does seem to work, and it gives fairly reliable and consistent values, you know, for what the physicists have been trying to achieve. So it's certainly worked well for them.
Yeah,
I would not argue that.
The experimental data really does back up the theoretical data, so it's not, you know, all that crazy. But here's a more important question: then, if we're talking about light and infinities and knowing everything, being everywhere, are we made of light?
I love that question, Brooks, and I feel the answer is yes. I feel we are, our minds, our consciousness, are basically all an extension of light. And I feel, as is obvious when, you know, you've read most of my books, is that I believe if God and light are not the same, that they are certainly intimately related. And I think that's how we are, or why we are conscious beings, is because we're interacting with this light network which exists all around us and which basically links us from one side of the universe to the other. So, yes, I do believe we are light beings, and I think through the learning process, and for those that may believe in reincarnation, as we continue to learn more and grow, that our spirits basically become, whether they're a greater intensity of light or a higher frequency of light, you know, I feel that our light spirits grow and learn as well.
Well, okay, so if we humans, we individual spirits, have conscious energy, light energy form, and that energy is everywhere all at once, what are we individuals supposed to make of this?
That is the $20,000 question. Personally, I believe that we are to, you know, basically learn, we are to praise God, and we are to enjoy life. Now, I think that there are so many questions that we obviously do not have all the answers to. You know, why do bad things happen to good people? There is so much of that that we cannot fully answer, but for whatever reasons, I feel God has made us spiritual beings, and I think that spirituality is probably based in the element of light.
I think we can come really close to that answer in the third hour, but let's talk a little bit about the EPR experiment. This was an argument against a concept that goes along with this logical conclusion that consciousness and thought may surpass
yes.
time. And it was an experiment put together by some really bright guys, Einstein and Rosen and others. And it was, this experiment was to test a thing called non-locality. So
exactly.
Help us understand what non-locality is.
Well, non-locality is the physics term to explain that if something happens in one part of the universe, that something else, because of that event, happens elsewhere, at a long distance away, whether it be the, 100 miles away or the other corner of the universe. It is, non-locality is the concept that the entire universe is linked and that it's linked instantaneously. Now, If you accept the fact that it's linked instantaneously, you know that, at least from our human perspective, it cannot be linked through any type of wave or particle because the maximum speed is the speed of light. So I like to think of it as basically being how we identify with consciousness. It appears to be a communication or informational network. And, you know, I think many of us can identify that perhaps communication or consciousness or information may well be different from light unless you have the perspective that light is everywhere at one time. And then it would make sense as well. But the EPR experiment, again, is a fairly complex experiment or mathematical proof, depending on how you want to look at the results, which state pretty conclusively that it is known that if something happens in one corner of the universe, something else is happening at another corner of the universe. We may not know what that something is, but we know that something's happening. Yeah, and I think that's probably the way I would explain it.
Analytical physics, we call it the observation effect, but Einstein expressed his frustration somewhere around the time of this experiment. He said, "You mean the moon exists because a mouse looked at it?" You know, he was talking about this thing called the observation effect, which
yes,
I think the EPR experiment just did a great job of quantifying, at least bringing it in the forefront of people who had world respect and could say that the observation of a human, not just an instrument, not just bombarding something with electrons or burning it in front of a photo ionization detector, but actually human observation changes the very thing that's being observed.
Oh, exactly. In fact, Einstein, what is so humorous or ironic in the whole experiment was that the EPR experiment was initially conceived as a thought experiment by Einstein. And later, and he conceived of the experiment because he wanted to show that non-locality did not exist. And I would emphasize the not. He wanted to prove it did not exist. And once the experiment was actually performed, it actually proved the exact opposite, that non-locality did exist. Einstein's favorite statement was that he did not believe God played dice with the universe. Which I'm sure many of us have heard before, and it was the EPR experiment that showed that indeed there was something. What was it? Spooky action at a distance. I think was how he explained it. Spooky action at a distance was indeed occurring. So it's been pretty impressive that something which Einstein did not believe in, did not want to believe in, and was actually trying to disprove, he never could, and in fact, the opposite was proven.
Well,
so it's amazing.
I have intense respect for the null hypothesis, but this is a good example of what happens when an intensely religious man tries to interpret experimental data as opposed to an intensely spiritual man. There is a difference.
Yes. Yes,
so,
I mean...
Well, I was just going to say, if this is possible, then can't it also be true that the universe is actually the sum of all the intentions of all the sentient beings in it, because we are originally from outside this universe. So we're really outside observers inside the universe.
Well, that's an excellent question. There are actually several perspectives on that. Many physicists feel that the universe simply exists because there are enough beings, such as you and I, within it, observing it. And I think it was Stephen Hawking actually made the quite incredible statement, and I say incredible because he was, for the longest time, felt to be an agnostic and atheist. But he actually made the radical statement that the reason the universe exists is that there must be someone or something outside of the universe observing it. So, you've got these different arguments and different perspectives, and who knows which one is right, but it certainly makes you realize that spirituality may be playing a bigger factor than we ever imagined.
Well, I contend that we are eternal beings having a mortal experience, that this is just a cosmic flashbulb in our total existence from the beginning, if there is one, to the end, if there is one of those, too. And that we are probably outside observers, or at least bona fide, totally empowered observers. And if this is possible, then can't it also be true that the mean intention, that is the average intention of the universe, can shift with awareness or a change in the state of consciousness of the beings who are responsible for the current condition of it?
Absolutely. I believe that completely. In fact, I think the one thing in my own personal life, which, for lack of a better word, I'll use scared, that really scared me once I fully understood the impact of the EPR experiment, was that things such as intangible as human thought were probably also having effects elsewhere in the universe. And, I always used to think that my thoughts were private and that perhaps they were even private to God, assuming at the time that he existed. And once I understood the full impact of the EPR experiment, there was no doubt anymore in my mind that my thoughts were not private, and you know, I really needed to clean up my act, because the universe is a lot broader and a lot less well understood than we thought it was. So that I agree completely with that.
We're going to have a great second hour. In your book, you quote Peck by writing, "Life is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery to be lived." And we are definitely living a magnificent mystery. We are going to take about a 3.5-minute break, and we'll be back after these messages with more of Lee Bauman and his great book, God at the Speed of Light. We'll be back after this. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters mean. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back.
The spice expands consciousness.
To X Squared Radio.
The spice is vital to space travel.
Where the past meets the future and the results are always positive. We appreciate you being with us tonight. Please tell a friend about us. This is a 3-hour radio program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure to let us know. We'll get with your affiliate and make sure they carry all 3 hours. recent announcement, we are now the number one radio program in Wales and now growing in Australia by leaps and bounds. In news, impossible, preposterous. These words are often thrown out when people declare certain things to be scientifically ridiculous. Aliens cannot reach the Earth in spaceships, they proclaim, because the distance between stars is too great. Telepathy is impossible since the brain does not emit or receive messages. And it's impossible to instantaneously transport an object from A to B because you can't know the location and momentum of all its atoms. Teleportation would violate the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Yet, if you carefully analyze these examples, you will realize that they are merely impossible today or in the near future. The real question is, are they impossible with technologies that lie decades, centuries, or even millennia beyond ours? Perhaps these impossibilities are merely very difficult engineering problems. The late Arthur C. Clarke has something to say about that. He said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. My guest tonight is Lee Bauman. His book, awesome, called God at the Speed of Light, The Melding of Science and Spirituality. We're talking about his book. We have laid a fantastic groundwork about light and the nature of it, and maybe in this hour we will talk about our nature and its relativity to that. Our phone lines are open. I know many of you sit out there and listen patiently, but we would like to hear from you. So if you will call us toll-free anywhere in the United States, 888-228-4494, or anywhere in the area of Canada, 877-489-6350, or anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And it's okay if you call in on your nickel. It doesn't make any difference to me, but most people have free long distance anyway, and some people use voice over internet. So if you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. And we also want to welcome our listeners with the STLI Media Network, courtesy of Kevin Smith, his great radio program, The Kevin Smith Show. In our last hour, we really got into some, I won't call it really deep advanced physics, because most listeners out there can grasp that part of it. They may have heard part of it from other guests out there. But we're about to go someplace that you don't go very often, and we're going to add some experimental data to back it up so that you can hold your own no matter where you are. Energy as waves collapses into matter when it is correspondingly observed. The question is, Lee, are humans powerful enough beings to cause this kind of non-local observation in the universe?
To answer that question, Brooks, I think the answer is a solid yes. I think that just through the few experiments that we've already discussed, double slit or quantum eraser, that it, you know, something has to be collapsing that wave function. And most of the best minds have pretty much come to the conclusion that it probably, mainly because they don't have any other good answers, it probably is human consciousness that is causing that collapse, and hence the whole idea that some type of observation or measurement has to be made to cause that collapse. So I feel it's a definite yes.
Well, it's a challenge for scientists. It's one thing in physics class or lab to go at the pre-drilled steel table or the granite test surface and set up mirrors and reflectors and lenses and lasers, but how do you do experiments with human consciousness?
I have a feeling you may have something in mind. Can you...
Well, you know, we've tied this into light, and it's easy to say light, but one of the things that we do on this program when somebody says, well, it was radioactive, the first question out of my mouth is, well, what species was it? I really want to know what the frequency is. So when we talk about light, what kind of spectrum of vibration are we talking about here?
Well, when I talk about light, I basically am using the physicist term to include all electromagnetic radiation. So
okay.
I'm talking not only visible light, which is just a tiny portion of that vast spectrum, but I'm also talking about non-visible light. So I'm including gamma rays, X-rays, ultraviolet light, infrared, microwave radiation, all the way down to TV, radio waves, and certainly cell phone waves would be included with that.
All right. So it's clear that maybe we have control, personal control over the vibration that we would assume as individuals, right?
Well, to be honest with you, I think that's getting into a realm that, at least for the current time, we have not proven. And I really consider myself a man of science. If something doesn't have at least some scientific basis for it, I really hate to conjecture. Honestly, just from my own perspective, even though I would fully back such an argument, that's all it would be an argument or a theory. I would keep an open mind and hope that we might someday, you know, be able to prove that, but I don't think we have that currently. Is there anything that you were thinking about?
Well, you know, when we talk about experimentation, we talk about different kinds of data or even different kinds of methodology, qualitative and quantitative. Qualitative would be something like, I'm going to toss something in the flame and see what color it makes. And quantitative would be, I'm going to take a precise measurement of exactly how many sulfur atoms are in this solution. So let's approach it from both points of view. I mean, to do a quantitative experiment using different qualitative values of observations, is there any value either way to the state of consciousness of the being doing the observing?
I just don't know that we have the answer to that question.
All right. Well, I'm trying to get as scientific as I can, because in this hour we want to go into the observation effect. In the last hour we stated that humans are powerful enough, or are empowered at least, to have the observation effect. And now we're trying to quantify the observation effect. So,
okay.
Maybe if I could say something like, okay, if they're angry or jealous or if they're fearful, the observing energy has a different quantitative value than it would from a person who is loving, hopeful, and merciful.
I understand. Right. I understand what you're saying. I don't think we have any evidence one way or the other regarding that. In fact, the question which is most often thrown at me, which, again, I don't have an answer to, is, does it have to be human consciousness? Can it be the consciousness of a tree, or can it be the consciousness of my cat who's lying here beside me? And, again, it really goes back to an argument of conjecture, but if we go back to the near-death experience, there are many people who, when they've been met by their deceased relatives or by God, they are often met by their deceased pets. And again, acknowledging that it's pure conjecture at that point, but that would be probably the best argument that I would have, that animals may indeed have spirits just as we humans do. And if we accept that, then they may be able to collapse that wave function just as well as humans.
Well, that being said, from a scientific point of view, a direct observation is valuable in experimentation. We're not talking about an empirical ruling or a guess. This is actual real input that is observed. So it has scientific value in a potential consciousness experiment.
I have read about, you know, some of the consciousness experiments. Certainly over the internet you can find all sorts of experiments that have been conducted. I am still weighing the evidence and have not reached any conclusions on many of those.
Me too. Yeah, I'm not concluding anything. I'm trying to ask another scientist that's obviously, you know, compiled an amazing amount of information and pointed us in a direction where, you know, we're on the threshold of being able to look at this and say, wait a minute, maybe the condition of my environment is under my control by my own observing energy. I am creating things around me, and worse than that, the thoughts that I have, the actions that I take, the things, the way that I treat other people has effect on other parts of the universe.
I definitely believe that. I definitely believe that our human thoughts have ramifications beyond our wildest dreams. Unfortunately, we don't know what those ramifications are. And, you know, can, other than the experiments, especially the EPR experiment that we already discussed, you know, is there any other evidence to the effect that it has to be human consciousness as opposed to my cat or dog, and what the actions at a distance are? Unfortunately, we just don't know. I tend to believe that it's telepathic communication or consciousness in general. I think that explains a lot of supernatural phenomenon that we have never been able to explain, things like psychic experiences, things like the collective unconscious, things like deja vu, perhaps. I think all those would fall in to this unexplained realm that we always thought that we would never have any scientific basis for. But as you say, I think we are now on the threshold of having a scientific argument for these phenomena, and I think it's a pretty exciting time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know what we scientists like to do when somebody says it's unexplained.
Sure, we like to say they're nuts.
Yeah, like nuts. Okay, let's put a team together and try to form an experiment to explain it. Let's come up with a hypothesis. So if we can make some gentle assumptions, not general, but just some gentle assumptions, like the universe is not a predetermined program from a single observer outside it. It's more the result of the participants in it. But my gentle question is this the only universe?
The multi-universe suggestion or hypothesis. I think it is certainly possible that there are parallel universes. Has any of my research given me any arguments one way or the other, you know, to one of those answers being the correct answer? I'm still weighing the evidence on that. I don't know. I do believe wormholes are very possible, considering that they may exist at the center of black holes. People would ask whether these wormholes might connect us to parallel universes, and that is possible, assuming that they do exist. Or could it be that they just connect us to different parts of our same universe? I hope someday we'll have those answers.
Either way, massive spinning black holes are generally considered to exist at the center of every galaxy.
Yes.
And are somewhat generally considered to be gravity lenses to at least very small areas that may open up to other areas of the universe. But also, at least mathematically speaking, in order to solve problems, we keep punching numbers because we can do that really well on our computers now and keep coming up with ideas. And we're trying to link all of the forces of the universe, at least the main four, into one super theory or one theory that encompasses everything.
Right.
And in order for it to become somewhat stable, we have to make assumptions. And one of those might be that there are more than three dimensions. So
yes.
How many dimensions are there?
Well, I love that question. If you believe in string theory, there are different string theories. There's like a superstring theory. There's a bosonic string theory. And what I find fascinating about those two particular theories, which are probably two of the main ones currently floating about, is that there have to be more than the four dimensions of space and time. One argues for 10 additional dimensions other than time, and the other argues for like a total of 26 dimensions, which just makes you realize that there's a whole, you know, there are multiple areas and dimensions out there that of which we have no knowledge, which then makes me think immediately of things like dark matter and dark energy. We have no idea what those things are in the universe either, and yet they probably contain well over 90% of matter and energy, you know, in the universe. So it's just another one of those observations that, indeed, the more we know, the more we realize we don't know, which is good. It keeps us humble.
Well, in the pontifications of physicists, as they go back and try to describe what is it that turned them into such strange creatures, I was reading Michio Kaku's book, and he remarked about his boyhood when he would look into the fish pond in Japan, and he wondered about the water universe compared to the air universe, and he tried to look at it from the standpoint of the carp, that swimming in his perfectly comfortable, you know, copious, food-friendly, non-predator world of the water universe, he really doesn't perceive the air universe. However, when it rains, the carp does see the ripple between the interface, at the surface of the water. The interface between the two universes, there is this ripple effect. And so although we can't make direct observations of other dimensions or other universes, we do see ripples coming through that don't originate in our universe or our dimension. So
I agree completely. In fact, I think light could well be one of those entities outside of our four dimensions of which we are seeing ripples, which is why we get this paradox of our human observation of light traveling at a specific speed and the apparent contradiction that if you're actually a light particle or a light wave, that you're everywhere in the universe at one time. You know, it's a definite contradiction in terms, but yet both appear to be true. So I agree completely. I think, in fact, was that Michio's book, Hyperspace, that you were quoting?
Right.
Yeah, it's a great book. In fact, I liked his discussion about how different dimensional beings might observe extra-dimensional characters, how we would observe an extra-dimensional god, how the beings of Flatland in their two dimensions would observe us humans, you know, in our four dimensions. And I think that's what I like in his description of how we would observe extra-dimensional beings, is it gives a great explanation for why throughout the world's various religions we all appear to have been observing God, you know, in all different types of forms, whether it be a burning bush or someone appearing bright as the sun, and yet there was always a common element, and that common element was always that of light. So I love Dr. Kaku's explanation for seeing extra-dimensional entities as ripples within our four dimensions, and how that can be an explanation for how we have observed, an extra-dimensional God, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And this could be why, even in a scientific world, although we're starting to act more like high priests with a scientific religion than we are real scientists, because we quite routinely throw out data, why is there such a disagreement among scientists over the number of dimensions? Can't somebody just prove it?
Wouldn't that be great? The argument seems to be in how small these dimensions are. The string theories would argue that these extra dimensions, whether they be a total of 10 or a total of 26, have to be incredibly small, and then the argument goes to, well, you know, how small can they be? Are they smaller than the Planck length, which is felt to be really the smallest determinant in size that is possible? And they really don't know. They've theorized that perhaps what we see as a single dimension in space could actually be more than one dimension because it's rolled up like a piece of paper. And all we see is a single line representing that roll of paper, when in reality it's multiple dimensions because they are all rolled up. So, I'm afraid our electron telescopes, or microscopes rather, just aren't able to give us that evidence that we so much desire.
Well, for that matter, what's an electron?
Yes.
And
I feel that, you know, most people identify an electron, or at least visualize an electron, as a particle. We've all seen the images of atoms in our textbooks, and these electrons are these little black dots that circle around the nucleus. And yet, the Copenhagen interpretation would argue that all matter, whether it be an electron or a proton or a neutron, is in reality a wave up until the point that it's observed. So if you begin visualizing an electron as a wave, how do you do that? I mean, do we really know what a wave looks like? And I would argue no. I don't think we do know what a wave looks like. But it certainly has unusual characteristics. It can go through every dimension equally, you know, at the same time, in a sphere, and at what point does that expanding sphere end? Right now it appears that it would end upon a contact with some measuring device or observation, at which point that entire wave collapses, and then we're back at square one again. You know, at what point in time did that sphere of wave collapse? Was it at the time that light wave first went through our cornea, or was it at the point that it passed our retina, or was it at the point that, you know, somewhere back in our brain where our human consciousness is argued to exist? And we just don't have that answer quite yet.
So we're not quite powerful enough to say something like, this brick wall does not exist, and I am going to walk my physical body right through it.
Well, you are well aware that physicists would argue that if we are not looking at that brick wall, and again, this is something Einstein hated, but the argument is that if no one is looking at that brick wall is not the concrete particulate thing that we think it is. It's a nebulous image of, or image is a bad term, it's a nebulous conglomeration of waves, which until we touch that wall of waves, or until we open our eyes and look at that wall of waves, up until that time, it's just a wall of waves. But as soon as we do look at it, all of those waves collapse, and we can actually place our hands on that brick wall and slam our fist into it. I would argue that even a blind person who has never seen anything from birth, that as soon as he or she placed his or her hand on that brick wall, that's the moment those brick waves collapse, and hence they could never walk through it, they could never place their hand through it. That appears to be what's happening, and again, why, we don't know, but we seem to have the hows worked out.
Well, I was going to say, your wife is probably sutured and bandaged. It's just such an interface.
Exactly.
I didn't even see that wall. It could not have been there.
Yes.
Right. I'll just remove these stitches because they're really not necessary.
Exactly. Or you run into a tree with your car and you say, well, I didn't see it. How could it have materialized? And
exactly.
I think I would argue, well, you ran into it, so that's how it materialized.
Well, I guess the next question then is, if that wall is going to exist whether we observe it or not, it's probably there because of the conscious observation and energy input of the person who erected it. And it's not up to the person that's walking up to it to dissolve what another person has put together.
See, I look at it slightly in a different manner. My feeling is, as a human with our five senses, that any one of those senses can collapse those waves, whether it be smell, taste, touch. I think when we say observation, we always allude to vision. But my feeling is it can be any of our human senses, that it's still a form of observation. If we touch something, we're basically observing it, but we're observing it by touch. I don't know if that muddies your question or not.
No, not at all. I was just trying to get to this, why are the additional dimensions even necessary? But it's quite amazing when we look out at the universe, and you mentioned this before, it's easy to pick up all the points of light because we have good contrast, but when we look at the movement of galaxies and galaxy clusters and superclusters, we see that their orbits, or at least the perturbation of one body of light on another, is many, many times that of what the visible matter could exert. So there's more to the universe than what meets the eye, or even any instrumentation that we have. So we see why the additional dimensions are necessary, right?
Honestly, my training does not give me a large argument for why those extra dimensions are necessary. I think they certainly are very compatible and complement the research that I've done. Right now, I think string theory, at least in my own mind, are the main factors arguing for extra dimensions, at least from our human perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that light appears to exist outside of time is probably the greatest proven argument that there are more dimensions. But beyond that, string theory still has a lot of kinks to be worked out.
Oh, I totally agree. And I'd love to be in on some of the brainstorming, but somebody has to earn a living around here. So we're actually these eternal beings having this mortal experience, limited by these short-range senses, and yet we seem to almost remember more than we admit. So why do we accept the universe the way it is?
Why do we accept the universe the way it is?
Yeah, I mean, if we're so sick and tired of our life condition, why don't we just change it?
Well, I think many of us have tried to do that. I think the Buddha, that was one of his big arguments, was life is suffering. And if we can try to exclude the reality of our day-to-day life, which, you know, theoretically you could do through meditation, then you could actually communicate or become one with God. So that was what he was trying to do, and that's what people try to do through meditation, is basically exclude the four dimensions of our space-time reality. And as many of us have found, that is that can be very difficult to do. You're in a room with your legs crossed and you're perhaps humming a mantra, and you've got people around who are probably making noises and coughing and moving about, and you know, it's a constant reminder that indeed you're within that four-dimensional reality that we call life.
Well, what about if you do it at 80 miles an hour on the freeway on a long drive, or you do it on a motorcycle ride in the country, or you do it while floating in the water with your mask and snorkel on, looking down at dolphins?
Yes.
There are lots of places and states that we could be and actually be in that would allow us to say life is good. But I'm reminded of the optimist and the pessimist. You know, the optimist says we live in the best of all possible worlds, and the pessimist fears that's true.
Yes.
So it's the same universe, it's just two different perspectives. But we stipulated already that our actions on Earth as humans, as individuals, are causing changes in other parts of the universe, right?
Yes.
So does that mean that other beings' actions in other parts of the universe are causing changes here?
I think so. I think absolutely so. You know, you ask what is probably one of the best arguments that extra dimensions exist, and I think it's the fact that we are conscious beings, just as simple as that. We have never been able to explain consciousness. We've always made up definitions and arguments that consciousness is purely a chemical reaction within our minds, and I think if you talk to most chemists and medical doctors, including myself, there just has to be more to it than chemical reactions. There's just something else going on. And I think the fact that we have dreams, that, you know, it's a form of communication. We don't always know what that form of communication is. And are aliens on the other side of the universe or in another galaxy, are their actions causing changes here? I think absolutely so. We don't know what those changes are, but I think they are having an effect.
Okay, that's good, that's good. But most people I see are not awake, and yet their actions are changing everything. I see,
yes,
prognosticators claiming that their predictions are coming true right and left. But my real question is, are they actually predicting things, or are they manifesting them so well that they actually come to pass?
I honestly would accept either argument.
Right.
I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other. I think when you begin looking at time and the fact that time does not exist for something as simple as a photon, which we really, you know, it's photons are all around us. Even in total darkness, there is non-visible light. we're talking about an entity which does not exist within our four dimensions. So I think I could not really argue against either of those concepts.
Well, maybe we exist in more than four dimensions. Where, I guess what I mean when I say people are not awake is they're not conscious that they're conscious.
Yes. I agree completely. I think there's just so much to this reality that we do not understand.
I mean, it's easy to look at a rock and say it's not conscious, but it's really not that much of a stretch to see humans who are not much more conscious than themselves.
I agree completely. In fact, you know, when you begin looking at deeper into quantum physics and quantum mechanics, you look at Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared.
Right.
So if you believe any about the four elements or four characteristics of light that we've been discussing all evening, you know, you have to realize that light, not only is it intimately related with the electron, but that has to extend into all matter itself. So even a rock, even the table that I'm looking at in front of me, it is an object containing light throughout every atom of its very being. And light, I feel, you know, has so many of the characteristics of God that we attribute to God, of consciousness, that if you wanted to argue that a rock was conscious, I would completely agree. Because we know, and we also know that matter is just a transmutation of energy, if you want to go, you know, that route. There are just so many arguments, I think, in the physics world for why consciousness is everywhere. It's inside of us. It's part of us. I think we communicate through it, and matter is a part of that. I think plants are just slow-moving animals, personally. So I feel that they have a consciousness as well.
And maybe planets as well. You know, when we
yes.
look at matter itself, we don't really know how to build it. But we have, I think, figured out how to take it apart. We've built the CERN super collider, and we're about to beam very fast beams of gold ions at one another to see if we can get a head-on collision.
Right.
And see if we can get those protons and neutrons to break each other apart so that we can spectrographically observe the piece as it comes apart. And that's not so hard to imagine. We reverse engineer technology all the time, and I guess this is what we're trying to do with nature. But I guess the real confusing thing is, where did all the matter come from? What energy was necessary to create all the matter in the universe? That's almost daunting, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, I suspect you are a believer, as I am, in the Big Bang. If you look at the prime mover arguments, you know, those ask, well, you know, even if we believe in the Big Bang as that singularity from which the universe was created, what existed before the Big Bang? Physicists will tell us it's things called quantum fluctuations. Honestly, I've read about quantum fluctuations, and I'm not sure it makes much sense to me. I understand the argument, but the bottom line is it seems pretty supernatural, you know, bottom line. So it's
yeah,
much
right.
easier for me to believe in a God than it is to believe in quantum fluctuations, although I am certainly a believer in the Big Bang.
Well, I mean, I've heard it explained that being a Higgs event, too. Higgs is sort of like the folding up of a protein when you're mashing all this matter together into a singularity in a black hole. It kind of folds up on itself, and in folding, it doesn't do so uniformly. It kind of does it like trying to wad up Velcro.
Yes.
And somewhere in there is a little elastic string that suddenly, unexpectedly, instantly
snaps. And when it does, it starts a chain reaction, which causes the whole thing to explode. But that's theoretical. What we have observed in our universe is an event called a supernova. So, first of all, let me hear your thoughts about supernovas, and we'll try to fill that in on how a higher order elements are created.
Sure. I mean, the one thing I like about the concept of supernovas is the fact that that's probably where, you know, just about every element on planet Earth came from. At least every element higher than iron had to be produced in a supernova. Our own sun is only capable of creating, you know, the lighter elements, and you require a supernova to produce every element higher or more dense than that of iron. So I like to be able to hold up a silver quarter and know that that came from a supernova explosion, as did many of the elements in our own bodies. So I think that's just a neat thing to think about. How spiritual does that make me? I'm not sure that either reinforces or argues against my spirituality one way or the other, other than the fact that I think it does give, there's an order of argument there, again, for the Big Bang having occurred. And I do believe in the Big Bang.
Yeah, I don't think it really tears apart spirituality to think of the process of the dying of a somewhat massive star. It's got to be at least 1.4 times the size of our star, but much more likely hundreds of times the mass of our star, or even a collection of stars as they wrap into each other, that have enough mass to cause the event that results in a supernova. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about right here, is the electron is negatively charged, and the proton's positively charged. And you mentioned the Bohr model of the atom, where we classically see a nice, perfect circle around a little dot called the nucleus, and that's where the atom revolves like a little planet around a sun. But under direct observation, that's not what we see at all. What we see is a probability cloud of little Christmas lights blinking on and off. We don't actually see electrons orbiting around the proton, and that's normal. But when gravity gets really, really intense, that electron falls into the proton, right?
And we basically get before the formation of a black hole, we get the neutron stars, right? Because the electrons,
it happens a little bit at first, and then a little bit more, and then all of a sudden it's like everybody heading for the checkout line at Walmart at one time. All the electrons fall into all the protons, and the concussion is what's called a supernova, and that literally consumes all the matter within whatever square root function that mass can reach. But in that energy event, new matter is created. New accretion disks are created, and thus new solar systems, right?
I would have to rely on your expertise at that point.
I know you rely on it for a second.
Sure.
I guess the thing that I'm saying is, now all that higher order matter is the same. Everywhere in that sphere of that supernova that's been created is now the same age. It's the same frequency, so to speak, the same size protons.
Yes.
And so when beings like us eat a carrot that comes from minerals that are in our planet that are created from the same supernova that created a star on 10 solar systems away, we might be consuming identical matter.
Yes, yes.
And so we're entangled.
I think so. I mean, I think from the moment of the Big Bang, these atoms and molecules that we are composed of, even though they've been transformed in many ways regarding supernovas and stellar furnaces, they are still the same atoms and electrons that occurred from the Big Bang. So we're all products of the same thing.
So how would you think this fuels the consciousness or the conscious claim that we are sentient and conscious, and if we're conscious that we're conscious, then we can actually, by our own will, by our own free will, manipulate the observation?
Yeah, Brooks, I understand what you're getting at, and I respect it, and I hold an open mind to that concept, but I'm just not aware of there being any scientific evidence to really give us any type of concrete link, except perhaps for the EPR experiment.
I know, I'm not trying to convert you. I'm trying to get you to pontificate.
Well, I have, and I'm just so stuck in the rut of being, you know, in the scientific method that until something has fairly good scientific credence associated with it, I'm maintaining an open mind, but that's about it. So I'm a bit stubborn.
Would you capitulate that photons are actually information being moved from one place to another?
Absolutely. Yes, I'm
so
a firm believer on that.
As an electron jumps up to a higher energy state and falls back down and emits this photon, which,
right,
without which I would be out of business, that is really information about the movement of that electron relative to its distance from that nucleus.
I agree completely. I think light and consciousness are basically one and the same.
Well, that's good. So when we're melding science and spirituality in this book, God at the Speed of Light, and you're making this case that that the two at least tenuously should be weaved back together again. I know at some time we separated science and religion because science wasn't going anywhere because religion had a firm hold on it. And
yes,
so we kind of separated the two, and now we're trying to weave them back together. And I guess some would make the argument that science has become another religion. If you can't get peer-reviewed, you're not going to go anywhere in it.
Well, I believe those that argue for intelligent design certainly believe that. I feel that the relationship between consciousness, spirituality, and light is a different perspective, so I think it complements the arguments of intelligent design, and I think a lot of the psychic research and the research that's been done in the area of near-death experience and even, the various religions that I've mentioned already, I think they all complement one another, building the case that God, consciousness, and light are all the same.
Well, I like the argument of original intelligent design. I wonder why, because I am, I wonder why I question everything. And I have to wonder, you know, gee, why go through all the work and the chance of creating something that literally cannot be controlled, but is allowed to unfold like weeds or an ecosystem of some kind. And when I ruminate on that question, why, I see that perhaps the civilization of humans on this world may have been here before and not got it right.
Well, personally, I am a firm believer in karma and reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what you've suggested, at least if I take it off onto that perspective, I fully agree with the argument for karma and reincarnation. I think it would give an argument for why bad things happen to good people. You know, when something happens to a young child, which just seems to be an argument for the non-existence of a loving and caring God. I think someone who understands the Indian and the Eastern religious concepts of karma and reincarnation, it at least offers some explanation. It's still, much like quantum physics, very difficult to grasp, but at least it offers some explanation, which probably is more than, you know, most of the Western religions offer, because we tend to say that, you know, karma and reincarnation, most Westerners do not accept those. But I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it makes an argument for why, if we don't get it right in the first life, that our spirits, and I believe it's spirits of light, continue to grow in intensity, perhaps frequency, and I think we're ever trying to achieve to get closer to the intensity and frequency of that being of light that so many have identified in the near-death experience.
Yep, I think you're on the right track there. I definitely definitely want to pursue that a little bit. In our third hour, we'll get we're going to talk about the placement of planets and the odds of the universe turning out the way it has. My guest is Lee Bauman. He is the author of God at the Speed of Light, and you can pick this book up anywhere, any of the online sellers, and probably at Barnes & Noble Bricks and Mortar. And, of course, you can always reach that through our website at x2-radio.com. And we'll be back after about 3.5 minutes of commercials, and then we'll start our third hour. So don't go anywhere. This is X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew, and this is where the past meets the future. So we'll be right back after these messages. Down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. PVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. PVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up PVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're glad you're back with us. We love spending these 3 hours with you each Sunday evening here from Eastern Washington State, right at the borders of Idaho and Canada. My AccuWindo forecast says it's 42 degrees and overcast outside. Of course, you can stop by and see us any time up here. We're finishing a new biodiesel plant up here. We're going to crush canola seed into oil, turn it into diesel fuel, clean burning fuel, try to link farming together with driving and energy independence. We think it's a better idea to grow our fuel than it is to dig it out of the ground, or even better than fighting for it. Do you remember the movie Wild Wild West with Will Smith? Well, NASA engineers are testing out a giant six-legged robot that could pick up and move a future moon base thousands of kilometers across the lunar surface, allowing astronauts to explore much more than just the area around their landing site. In a 2005 report about its exploration plans, NASA said it wanted to set up a base at a fixed location on the moon. After initially returning humans there in 2020, but a gargantuan robotic vehicle called Athlete, that's the all-terrain, hex-legged extraterrestrial explorer, could change that. Measuring about 7.5 meters wide with legs more than 6 meters long, the robot could act essentially like a turtle, carrying the astronauts' living quarters around on its back. The Internet could soon be made obsolete. The scientists who pioneered it have now built a lightning-fast replacement capable of downloading entire feature films within seconds, at speeds about 10,000 times faster than a typical broadband connection. The grid will be able to send the entire Rolling Stones back catalog from Britain to Japan in less than 2 seconds. The latest spin-off from CERN, the particle physics center that created the web, the grid could also provide the kind of power needed to transmit holographic images, allow instant online gaming with hundreds of thousands of players, and offer high-definition video telephony price of a local call. The grid has been built with dedicated fiber optic cables and modern routing centers, meaning there are no outdated components to slow the deluge of data. The 55,000 servers already installed are expected to rise to 200,000 within the next 2 years. That network, in effect, a parallel internet, is now built using fiber optic cables that run from CERN to 11 centers in the United States, Canada, the Far East, Europe, and around the world. How about that? You didn't think it could get faster than this. You haven't seen anything yet. Hopefully, very hopefully, it will stay as free and independent as it is right now, so that we can stay on the air and others like us as we explore the mysteries of the universe and the Earth. Our guest tonight is Lee Bauman. He's a medical consultant in Birmingham, Alabama. He has written an awesome book called God at the Speed of Light. It's easy reading, even for the non-physicist, and hopefully we haven't gone too far beyond your CVs. This one covers the melding of science and spirituality, and I think Lee has a couple more books, and maybe he'll tell us about those in just a second. In this hour, we're going to talk about the grand design. There are some remarkable probabilities that need to be outlined first. So, Lee, where do we start?
Well, that's a good question, Brooks. There are just so many further arguments above and beyond those of physical light and the supernatural attributes that we've discussed already. One of my favorite concepts dealing with grand design is what I call the Alpha and Omega. We currently feel that the universe is continuing to expand, and not only is it continuing to expand, but it's felt that that expanse may actually be speeding up. Before, we actually thought the expanse was slowing down. But be that as it may, whether it's speeding up or slowing down, it's felt that there is an excellent chance that the universe may end in what is known as the Big Freeze, which is where it just continues to expand forever and the universe dies a cold death. What I find interesting in that particular scenario is that one of the most prevalent theories is that after 10 to the 36th power years, so that's a 1 followed by 36 zeros, that every proton, or I'm sorry, actually that's the half-life of what is known as proton decay, 10 to the 36th power years. It's felt that half of all protons after 10 to the 36 years will degrade into light. Given enough time, actually, all protons would actually degrade into light. And what I like is the fact that whether you're a believer in God or not, with that argument, you have to acknowledge that given enough time, we are all going to be spirits of light. And everything, for that matter, not just our ashes to ashes and dust to dust, but all matter in general. We will be light. So I think that's a neat concept and fits again in with my research. There are so many other arguments for intelligent design. There are, you mentioned earlier, Brooks, about the four forces of nature which physicists have been trying to draw together into a grand unified theory or a super theory, a theory of everything. Which brings the four forces of nature together. Currently, we identify that there are three atomic forces known as the electromagnetic force being one, the strong force, and the weak force being the other two. Currently, physicists have been able to bring conceptual designs of how the universe was created by combining those three forces or laws of nature together. The one which is never fit, the fourth one, is the power of gravity, that we've just never been able to bring that into a conceptual equation like Einstein's E equals MC square equation. So, you know, just a simple equation which unites those four forces of nature. What has been identified in physics is that these laws of nature are so incredibly fine-tuned in each of their definitions that even the most minor alterations of any of them would have precluded probably not only life itself on this planet, but perhaps even the entire universe as we know it. That the fact that perhaps different laws of nature might have come about or may even exist are some of the arguments for why there might be parallel universes out there that we, you know, are not aware of. Some theories are that these parallel universes have different laws of nature than our own, and that probably for the vast majority of them, there is nothing such as life, certainly as we know it. I haven't drawn a conclusion one way or the other whether I agree with there being parallel universes, but you know, no one can prove that they do not exist. But I think from the intelligent design standpoint and from our own perspective, it is well acknowledged that the laws of nature, if they were thrown off even the most mild degree, we would not be here. So the fine-tuning of the laws of nature is one argument in the intelligent design realm. What I like as a physician is to look at the chicken or the egg argument for life itself.
Right, right.
And simply speaking, we know that some scientists, Stanley Miller was probably the best known, who put together what he felt were the elemental characteristics of primeval Earth, which consisted of water and some electricity generating sparks and some elemental products of the early Earth, and he was able to create a couple of amino acids. What often is not told is that this, what appears to be simple experiment, was not really all that simple. Some of his earliest experiments, he produced nothing more than just tar, and there were no amino acids at all. But eventually he did alter parameters of his experimentation enough that he was able to generate a couple of amino acids. That made the press and was a big news item, I think, back in the early 1950s. And it was felt that indeed Darwin's theory of evolution, you know, was on the right track, and perhaps early Earth had all the essential ingredients to make life. What was not really so well pointed out was that, first of all, there are many, many different types of amino acids. And
right.
For amino acids to in any way produce life, they have to build or have to make up proteins. Well, the question is, where do proteins come from? Well, proteins come from something known as transfer RNA, which is described well in the medical field. So then the question becomes, well, where does RNA come from? Well, RNA comes from DNA. And then, of course, the last question is, well, where does DNA come from? Well, DNA comes from DNA. So the prime mover argument reaches a stumbling block in that, you know, it seems like the buck ends there. And if when you realize how complex these molecules are, I have to look with some skepticism at that argument and the concept that life has come about as a result of just lightning strikes in a primordial Earth.
Well, that's a pretty easy, a good conclusion, but it's not one so easily come to. The author of, I think it was Biochemical Predestination, which was a best-selling textbook for about 5 years, until a grad student asked the writer in a classroom lecture that very question, where did the first protein come from? Because the class was all about, you know, gradual mistakes being made in folding and unfolding complex proteins, and that this
mutations
come from. And he couldn't answer the question, and he went back and edited his comments and his book, and became a proponent for intelligent design. And although I don't really want to get into the question of whose intelligence are we talking about, because that would be easy to get off on a wrong track in the 35 or 40 minutes we have left. What I want to get to is the odds that a universe like ours would exist, obviously, are very, very small. I think it's, what, 1 times 10 to the 126 to 1. But that's also an argument that if our universe could only exist this way and no other way, then there's really only one chance that our universe could form this way, and given enough time, it would. But the problem with evolution, whether it be the molecular level or the biological level, paleontological level, is there's not enough time in the universe for those kinds of mutations to take place.
I am so glad you brought that up, because, you know, not only do you have the complexity arguments, but we've got the actual observation of the fossil record, which is pretty cut and dry. When you realize how many mutations actually survive in Darwinian's theory of evolution, you realize that for something, for just the observation of what is known as the Cambrian explosion, which is the time period during which so many of the multicellular plants and animals developed back during the Cambrian period, computer models shows that it would have literally taken hundreds of millions of years for that type of diversity to have evolved. And yet, the fossil record shows it evolved over a span of only 5 million years. So you're talking a difference of 5 compared to hundreds of millions of years, and that's a big difference.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of two things happened, and we're going to leave the third out because it's just not possible for cells to differentiate and say, okay, you take care of this job and I'll take care of that one, and for DNA to become immensely combined into a system as complex even as a, you know, a fish. But the other two are that some single intelligence or some committee of intelligence has said, all right, we have a planet where we have liquid water. Looks like it's not going to be baked to a crisp. It's not going to freeze solid like a ball. What kind of life do you want to put on it? And you got 5 million years to come up with the ideas. Or life did have a chance to evolve perhaps elsewhere and pass this way and populate this planet.
Yeah,
those are really the only two possibilities, right? Intelligent placement or intelligent creation.
Exactly. I mean, my feeling is if you flip a coin 10,000 times and every time it comes up heads, you can either argue that that has occurred as the result of statistics, which is pretty hard to buy, or you have to accept the fact that maybe it's a two-headed coin. So personally, I think, you know, things have been designed to yield what we're observing. And, of course, that's purely a personal opinion. You begin to look at things like, I think you alluded to just before the break, the placement of the planets. What I just find, even to this day, it's one of my favorite intelligent design arguments, is mathematical astrologic models show that as planets form about the central star, and this would apply basically for any solar system, that they apply or that they form at a particular distance from that star. And the distances are basically X, 2X, 4X, and they keep doubling. So if we apply that to our own solar system, indeed, Mercury is at distance X, which happens to be about 50 million kilometers from the sun. Venus is the next planet, and sure enough, it's at distance 2X, or about 100 million kilometers. You then have Mars, which is at 4X, or about 200 million kilometers. You've got the asteroids, which are at about double that, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, which fit the pattern completely. Now, the figures are not exact, but they are so close that it really, I think, would impress, you know, the average individual. There's only one exception, especially now that we've kicked Pluto out. There's really only one exception, and that is Earth. It lies at a distance 3X. It's not, you know, the X, 2, 4, 8. It's at a distance 3X, or 150 million kilometers from the sun, where no planet should be. And yet, it's funny, it just happens to be at the precise location which has allowed for liquid water, as well as the other two phases of water, and has allowed for life to form. I think statistics have measured out that if our planet was only a couple of degrees variance from that particular distance from the sun, that there would be no life here at all. So,
so it's possible that, in fact, it's quite probable that Earth was captured in orbit here, that it came through space or through dimensions or whatever, and arrived here in orbit around this sun, in between the harmonic accretion disk resultant orbits of a normally developed solar system.
You certainly have to ask how it got here, don't you? Because it's it just should not exist.
And then you look at the molecular makeup, you would expect to be in any accretion disk somewhat homogeneous, at least for planets and moons. But we are primarily iron and nickel, and the moon is primarily aluminum and titanium, with vastly different oxygen contents, about 2% to be exact. How could that be if they were developed out of the same matter?
Yes. Yeah, I think they're still arguing over that one.
Well,
I mean, you're aware of the theory that perhaps an asteroid or a comet the size of Mars hit Earth and hence the formation of the moon, but we still don't have the answers to really sort out what happened there.
I'm aware of a couple of pieces of data that might make that theory not hold a lot of water, and one is that based on the mass of the moon and the arrangement of its crust and the fact that it rings like a bell when it's struck by things, that it may in fact be hollow.
That would be an interesting finding, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, we're not really going there. The Chinese and the Japanese are there now. They're flying around it, taking high-resolution pictures. But, all right, let's get past the molecular intelligent design and the fossil intelligent design. What about the universe itself? There's a claim in Genesis that the universe was created in 6 days. And yet, when I read Genesis, I don't see the word day showing up until the third day, which is when the Earth gets its sun and moon. So what time frame are we actually talking about here?
Well, I'm so glad you brought up that question, Brooks. That was certainly something along with Darwin's theory of evolution, which always bothered me as I struggled with, you know, my spirituality, because I think the Bible makes so many, you know, good arguments and gives us such what I think is good historical data that when you read about the 6 days of Genesis, so much of that really conflicted with my scientific basis. But what I found was, as I was doing all this reading on quantum physics and intelligent design and whatnot, I came across one author by the name of Gerald Schroeder, who has written many great books. I think the one is Genesis and the Big Bang, if I'm not mistaken, but he's written several great books. I believe he is a nuclear physicist at MIT, if I'm not mistaken, and so his credentials are impeccable. But he came up with a great, which I think is just the greatest theory to bring together the story of Genesis and our scientific picture, as many physicists would tell us, dating all the way back from the Big Bang. What Gerald Schroeder realized was, you know, for the first 3 days, and I put days in quotation marks, you really couldn't state that those were Earth days, because Earth, according to Genesis, wasn't formed until the third day. So these could not be 24-hour days. So then the question goes back, well, what type of days, you know, might they have been? Schroeder comes up with an excellent explanation. And using his scientific and mathematical mind, he came up with something which he termed a universal day. For inquiring minds, it's based on the natural log E scale, which, please don't ask me to explain that because I'd probably not do a very good job. But it's a mathematical scale based upon exponential changes. And what he did was, when he applied this natural log E scale to his universal days instead of a 24-hour day, the descriptions in Genesis matched up perfectly with the scientific scenario. Day one in Genesis describes the creation of the universe and light separates from dark. The equivalent description in science would be the production of the Big Bang. Light literally breaks free, and eventually electrons bond to their atomic nuclei, and the last stages of that first day, galaxies are beginning to form. Day two, according to Genesis, the heavenly firmament forms. Science states that the disk of the Milky Way has formed and our sun is now burning bright. Day three, according to Genesis, oceans, dry land, first life appears. The scientific equilibrant would be that the earth is cooled, liquid water, and first life have appeared. Day four in Genesis, the sun, moon, and stars become visible, and the scientific equal is that the atmosphere becomes transparent. Photosynthesis, because the atmosphere has become transparent, photosynthesis now begins to occur, and as a result of photosynthesis, oxygen is produced, which now makes possible for the first time the events of day five, which is that the first animal life, complex animal life appears, including reptiles and winged animals. And then the scientific equal is that the first multicellular animals, winged insects, appear. In day six, land animals and mammals and humans appear, according to Genesis. And from the scientific perspective, we now have extinction of the dinosaurs, eventual repopulation of most of these complex multi-celled animals, including humans. So the two just fit together so well, and it brings together, you know, what I've always felt to be two conflicting concepts, being trying to meld science with our story of Genesis. So Gerald Schroeder has offered a great explanation for that.
I like it. It fits together and makes sense, and we are not talking about 24-hour days, and we're not talking about something that's so difficult to understand, and now we have the molecular possibility and the biological possibility that life could be designed and be put together just like that. Now, I guess the question would be, many people think that God is over there. God is up there, or God is behind some kind of veil, or that we are so separate from the Creator that we can neither please Him nor be like Him or have any potential like unto Him. But this idea of superluminal communication has kind of opened a doorway here, that maybe God is not so far away, at least from us, and that maybe, although there is communication instantaneously, or maybe exchange of light between Him and us, or her and us, depends on, I don't really care, it doesn't matter to me, as long as you have some kind of idea, or some kind of imagination, but are we so different? Or do we have the potential to be anything? I would ask you that.
And I, you know, I would agree completely with what you're suggesting, because I believe very much that we are just extensions of God. We are just extensions of that cosmic consciousness which exists throughout the universe. And I think that is why so many phenomenon that we attribute to being paranormal or supernatural, like psychic visions and dreams and the collective unconscious, even prayer for that matter, it all equates to the fact that it's all extensions of light and God. What I've even found interesting, since I mentioned prayer as one of those supernatural phenomenon, is many near-death experiencers, when they were on the other side, noticed beams of light radiating up from planet Earth, and they asked the spirits that they were with, what were those beams of light? And Danion Brinkley and Betty Eady both were told that those were the prayers of individuals on Earth. So yes, I think we are purely extensions of God, including our prayer. I think that's how all spirit beings communicate, is through this cosmic consciousness or light or whatever you want to call it, non-locality.
Well, there are admittedly different levels of prayer. I think it's pretty clear. Some are the repetitious or ritualistic prayers, like prayers over food or some kind of rite or ritual. The other is the yearnings of our heart, you know, when we cry out, you know, woe is me, or
yes,
how can I overcome this bad habit or learn this thing? But I think maybe the highest order of prayer is when we pray for each other and we apply that intention toward one another. And when I look at, you mentioned the Bible several times, the commandments that the Christ gave, they weren't a whole lot, and they weren't anything like the Old Testament commandments. The basic commandments were love one another, love your neighbor, and love God. That sounds pretty good.
I could not agree more. I think so many of us were brought up under the old fundamentalist religion that turned many of us against religion, you know, back in our younger days, and just being reminded that there are totally different books apart from the God who appears to be described in the Old Testament, whether it be the New Testament or other sacred texts, you know, throughout our planet, where God is really so loving and caring and just seems to be a very accepting God who's willing to accept us even with our faults.
Well, I think generally people are still against religion. Now, not against spirituality. Mark, mind you, they're two completely different things. Just watch the evening news or the cable news channels and you'll see the results of religion.
Yes.
This thing about spirituality, this thing about superluminal connection, about collective consciousness, and I would say that there's probably also something called collective unconsciousness, because
yes.
I certainly see that on the evening news as well. As we awaken, though, as we remember who we are and what we were made of before we became physical beings with skint knees and allergies and loves and jealousies and lost jobs and all the things that go with it, those experiences have cumulative effect on the total energy of the being itself. And you can see that where there are two beings, there are no two beings alike. They're all individual. And I guess I would ask you the question that, you know, is our physical body the shape of who we are forever or were? Or is there some spiritual genetics that comes forward with us?
Well, I think that's a great question, Brooks. The bottom line is there's no way to give any evidence one way or the other, but my own personal feeling is that, you know, despite the fact that the Bible states that we are made, that we are made in God's image, I tend to think it's a spiritual image as beings of light. Personally, I don't think our physical bodies have much of a relationship to God other than we're just containers for our spirit. But again, that's purely a personal view, and I don't have any scientific evidence that supports that one way or the other. But
there's a little bit of evidence that sort of makes you say, like, for instance, identical twins, that over time, as they approach adulthood, they look quite different because their DNA, their genes, have chosen to build different proteins from one another. That the genetic makeup of a person is only part of the story. The rest of it is environmentally influenced, and some of that environment is actually the stress that we perceive.
Yes, I agree 100%. I also find it fascinating. There's just been some recent medical studies done which show that identical twins are actually not identical as far as genetic makeup is as we once believed. So that's just an interesting update from that.
Wow, that's nice to know. So they don't have to wear the same clothes anymore.
There you go.
I almost lost my train of thought because I wanted to make a point about this idea, because in the beginning of your book, or near the beginning, you mention ghosts. Now, we don't
Yes.
normally do ghost stories on this program, but you present a different angle on it. So could we cover ghosts at this moment?
Yeah, well, you know, I've never been a believer in ghosts, but I'll have to admit, since having published my books and done the research where, you know, I believe that we're all beings of light and spirits of light, I found it quite interesting when, I guess it's been close to 25, 30 years ago, I was sleeping and our bedroom was pitch black, and for some reason I woke up and I sat up in bed, and there in front of me was a white, translucent figure, and it appeared to be a Civil War soldier dressed in a Civil War uniform with epaulets on his shoulders. And I thought, no, you know, that this isn't happening, because I've never experienced any type of paranormal events in my life. So I blinked once, and it was still there. And I thought that was unusual. And I blinked a couple more times, and it vanished. And I was just, you know, left sitting up staring at where this apparition had been, and suddenly my wife, who's lying next to me, sleeping, she screams. And I hadn't made any noise. I wake her up and I say, you know, Brenda, what's going on? And she tells me about this nightmare she's had, just had, where she was being chased by a white apparition. Now, she couldn't really describe it in much more detail, but the chronologic series of events, along with a description which matched at least to some degree, made you wonder if there wasn't a connection, and it certainly made me think that, maybe there are things such as ghosts.
Well, I thought it peculiar, or at least interesting, that a being who had passed away and evidently had decided not to immediately depart this planet appeared not only human, but also in the dress of his day. That nothing about the man had changed. So if it hadn't changed after he left this life, had it changed before he got here?
Yeah, those are all great questions. And, you know, the only thing that I could use to explain what might or might not have been happening goes back to descriptions of people who had experienced near death. And so many of these people would describe realms where there would be people and figures who were often described as kind of gray and confused, often walking with shuffled steps. And that there are enough stories like that that I tend to believe that there appear to be some spirits which, much like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is a Buddhist work, often describes spirits that when they first pass away, they're not aware that they're dead. And there's a time period which can vary before the person actually realizes that they have departed. Much like people who've experienced near death, it takes them a period of time before they realize that they've separated from their body, and often it's when they first see their body, you know, laying below them as they're hovering overhead. I think there's still a lot that we're learning about the other side and ghosts and the spirit world.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there's a lot to learn and a lot to wonder about, but you don't really see too many really ancient ghosts. A few hundred years old, maybe. But sooner or later, they figure out it's time to move on. Somebody may come to them and say something like, George, you've been dead for 120 years. If you want to reincarnate, it's really time to move on into this other realm. And the other realm we really don't know anything about. But what we imagine, what we, at least from the spirit texts that we have in our hands, is that this world of disembodied spirit is a world without time. It is a world perhaps at the speed of light, but the universe in the third dimension keeps going on, and sooner or later that spirit wants to continue to grow and so has to go through the birth process again. And previous memories are wiped away, but the age of a soul, with the experience and the perhaps habits and patterns that it develops over the eternities, goes forward with it, hopefully, prayerfully. We are evolving as beings. I think what you've said tonight kind of leads me to believe that.
Well, I agree. In fact, I was somewhat looking for that ghost to return, and I tried to be quite receptive and open-minded that perhaps he would return, and, you know, whether he was seeking something, perhaps a means by which I could intervene to help him pass forward, you know, on that other side. I didn't know what he might have been looking for, but I was open-minded to actually seeing him again, and never did. Which actually brings me to another area in my role as a physician is I now believe that it's very important for some individuals as they lay dying to know, to have their relatives actually verbalize to them
sure.
that, hey, you know, it's okay to let go and to cross over. Don't feel you have to stick around for us.
Yeah, we
and that can be that can be very important.
We do fight for our mortality, and I'm not at all advocating that you give up on life, because this is an amazing
no.
experience, and we are in an amazing time. Look what we can do. Look what we can imagine. Is there nothing that you cannot learn? No. You can learn everything.
Yes.
So get started. Lee, it has been, I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to have you on the program. I just love these conversations.
Likewise for me. It's been a thrill.
3 hours goes in about 15 minutes, it seems.
It does. It goes very rapidly.
Where are you speaking next? Are you speaking somewhere? You have a lecture coming up?
I have what I consider my fantasy job. I get to travel about once a month doing either astronomy or some type of technology lectures on cruise boats, as well as giving talks on my research really around the world. I'm thrilled that I actually am going to be giving a science and spirituality series of lectures aboard the Queen Mary II in January. So if any of your listeners are interested in something like that, it leaves and is round trip from Fort Lauderdale aboard the Queen Mary II, and they would want to contact www.omrizon.com, and Omrizon is spelled O-M-R-E-I-Z-E-N. But I am blessed. I get to do exactly the type of thing which... you know, you couldn't pay me to do something like this. It's just pure love, and I am very fortunate to be able
to
do this.
Get a job like that. And do you have a website?
I do. My own personal website is at www.writers.net, and at the top of the website, you can just type in Bauman, and it would go straight to my page. And Bauman is B-A-U-M-A-N-N. There are two N's at the end.
Wonderful. All right, we've got that
information. Well, thank you for asking.
We'll definitely put it on the website so people can find it. I think that's really cool, going on a cruise and having your consciousness and your awareness increased at the same time that you get to enjoy the ocean and the stars.
Well, I know I certainly enjoy it.
An absolute pleasure. We are completely out of time. I wish we could go for another hour, but I definitely want to have you on the program again. So,
thank you, and thank you so much for having me. It's been a real thrill.
Well, I appreciate that. I really do. I would tell you that, you know, we need you a lot more than you need us, and we're glad that you come on, and our listeners appreciate it. Tomorrow morning when they come into work, they're going to enjoy it. Usually when I don't get any calls, it means everybody's hanging right at the edge of their laptop and they don't want to call in and interrupt the show.
Well, it's been a blessing, and I thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. And good evening, and have a wonderful week.
Thank you, Brooks. You too.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, there you have it, Earth Explorers. Don't forget, in about 3 weeks, the Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 3, Unlocking the Secret, will hit the presses. We'll let you know by newsletter, and you have a great week out there. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening.
Are you talking to me now, Brooks?
Because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. reach out for the good in people and help to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.